Are you bruised badly enough to need a salve? She asked.
Not really, I admitted.
I thought not, she said. But after I have lost a fight, I rarely wish to have people tell me how I lost it.
She flashed me a small, secret smile. I smiled back. We continued to walk, and Pentha kept hold of my arm, subtly guiding us through a grove of trees, then up a steep path carved through a small bluff. Eventually, we came to a secluded dell that had a carpet of wild papaver flower blossoming among the grass. Their loose, blood-red petals were almost exactly the same color as Pentha's mercenary reds.
Vachette told me barbarians have strange rituals with your sex, Pentha said. She told me if I wanted to bed you, I should bring you to some flowers.
She gestured around.
These are the best I could find in this season.
She looked up at me expectantly. Ah, I said. I expect Vachette was having a bit of a joke with you. Or perhaps a joke with me. Pentha frowned, and I hurried to continue. But it is true that among the barbarians there are many rituals that lead up to sex. It is somewhat more complicated there. Pentha gestured, sullen irritation.
I should not be surprised, she said. Everyone tells stories about the barbarians. Some of it is training, so I can move well among you.
Rye, however.
Since I have not been out among them yet, they also tell stories to tease me.
What sort of stories? I asked, thinking of what I had heard about the Adem and the Lathani before I had met Tempe. She shrugged, slight embarrassment.
It is foolishness. They say all the barbarian men are huge.
She gestured far above her head, showing a height of more than 7 feet.
Nadin told me he went to a town where the barbarians ate a soup made of dirt. They say the barbarians never bathe. They say barbarians drink their own urine, believing it will help them live longer.
She shook her head, laughing and gesturing, horrified amusement. Are you saying, I asked slowly, that you don't drink yours? Pentha froze mid-laugh and looked at me, her face and hands showing a confused, apologetic mix of embarrassment, disgust, and disbelief. It was such a bizarre tangle of emotions, I couldn't help but laugh, and I saw her relax when she realized the joke. I understand, I said. We tell similar stories about the Adem. Her eyes lit up.
You must tell me as I told you. It is fair.
Given Tempe's reaction when I'd told him of the word fire and Lathani, I decided to share something else. They say those who take the red never have sex. They say you take that energy and put it into your K-10, and that is why you're such good fighters. Pentha laughed hard at that.
I would have never made the third stone if that were the case, she said,
wry amusement.
If keeping from sex gave me my fighting, there would be days I could not make even a fist.
I felt my pulse quicken a bit at that.
Still, she said, I can see where that story comes from. They must think we have no sex because no Adem would bed a barbarian.
Ah, I said, somewhat disappointed. Why have you brought me to the flowers, then?
You are now of Ademre, she said easily. I expect many will approach you now. You have a sweet face, and it is hard not to be curious about your anger.
Pentha paused and glanced significantly downward.
That is, unless you are diseased.
I blushed at this. What? No, of course not.
Are you certain?
I have studied at the Medica, I said somewhat stiffly. The greatest school of medicine in all the world. I know all about the diseases a person might catch, how to spot them, and how to treat them.
Pentha gave me a skeptical look. I do not question you in particular, but it is well known that barbarians are quite frequently diseased in their sex.
I shook my head. This is just another foolish story. I assure you, the barbarians are no more diseased than the Adem. In fact, I expect we may be less. She shook her head. Her eyes serious.
No, you are wrong in this. Of 100 barbarians, how many would you say were so afflicted?
It was an easy statistic I knew from the Medica. Out of every 100? Perhaps 5? More among those who work in brothels or frequent such places, of course. Pentha's face showed obvious disgust, and she shivered.
Of 100 Adem, none are so afflicted, she said firmly.
Absolute. Oh, come now. I held up my hand, making a circle with my fingers. None?
None, she said with grim certainty. The only place we could catch such a thing is from a barbarian, and those who travel are warned.
What if you caught a disease from another Adem who had not been careful while traveling? I asked. Pentha's tiny heart-shaped face went grim, her nostrils flaring.
From one of my own?
Vast anger.
If one of Ademre were to give me a disease, I would be furious. I would shout from the top of a cliff what they had done. I would make their life as painful as a broken bone.
She gestured disgust, brushing at the front of her shirt in the first piece of Adem hand talk I had ever learned from Tempe.
Then I would make the long trek over the mountains into the Tal to be cured of it. Even if the trip should take 2 years and bring no money to the school, and none would think the less of me for that.
I nodded to myself. It made sense. Given their attitudes about sex, if it were any other way, disease would run rampant through the population. I saw Pentha looking at me expectantly. Thank you for the flowers, I said. She nodded and stepped closer, looking up at me. Her eyes were excited as she smiled her shy smile. Then, her face grew serious.
Is it enough to satisfy your barbarian rituals, or is there more that must be done?
I reached down and ran my hand along the smooth skin of her neck, sliding my fingertips under the long braid so they brushed the back of her neck. She closed her eyes and tipped her face up toward mine.
They are lovely, and more than enough, I said, and bent to kiss her. I was right, Pentha said with a contented sigh as we lay naked among the flowers. You have a fine anger.
I lay on my back, her small body curled under my arm, her heart-shaped face resting gently on my chest. What do you mean by that? I asked. I think anger might be the wrong word.
I mean Vaven, she said, using the Ademic term. Is that the same?
I don't know that word, I admitted.
I think anger is the right word, she said. I have spoken with Bashet in your language, and she did not correct me.
What do you mean by anger, then? I asked. I certainly don't feel angry. Pentha lifted her head from my chest and gave me a lazy, satisfied smile.
Of course not, she said. I have taken your anger. How could you feel such a way?
Are you angry, then? I asked, sure I was missing the point entirely. Pentha laughed and shook her head. She had undone her long braid, and her honey-colored hair hung down the side of her face. It made her look like an entirely different person. That and the lack of the mercenary reds, I supposed.
It is not that kind of anger. I am glad to have it.
I still do not understand, I said. This could be something barbarians do not know. Explain it to me as if I were a child. She looked at me for a moment, her eyes serious. Then she rolled over onto her stomach so she could face me more easily.
This anger is not a feeling. It is...
She hesitated, frowning prettily.
It is a desire. It is a making. It is a wanting of life.
Pentha looked around, then focused on the grass around us.
Anger is what makes the grass press up through the ground to reach the sun, she said. All things that live have anger. It is the fire in them that makes them want to move and grow and do and make.
She cocked her head.
Does that make sense to you?
I think so, I said. And women take the anger from men in sex. She smiled, nodding.
That is why afterward a man is so weary. He gives a piece of himself. He collapses. He sleeps.
She glanced down.
Or a part of him sleeps.
Not for long, I said.
That is because you have a fine, strong anger, she said proudly. As I have already said, I can tell because I have taken a piece of it. I can tell there is more waiting.
There is, I admitted.
But what do women do with the anger?
We use it, Penta said simply.
That is why, afterward, a woman does not always sleep as a man does. She feels more awake, full of the need to move, often full of desire for more of what brought her the anger in the first place.
She lowered her head to my chest and bit me playfully, wriggling her naked body against me. It was pleasantly distracting. Does this mean women have no anger of their own? She laughed again.
No! All things have anger. But women have many uses for their anger, and men have more anger than they can use, too much for their own good.
How can one have too much of the desire to live and grow and make? I asked. It seems more would be better.
Penta shook her head, brushing her hair back with one hand. No, it is like food. One meal is good. Two meals is not better.
She frowned again.
No, it is more like wine. One cup of wine is good. Two is sometimes better, but 10?
She nodded seriously.
That is very much like anger. A man who grows full of it is like a poison in him. He wants too many things. He wants all things. He becomes strange and wrong in his head. Violent.
She nodded to herself.
Yes, that is why anger is the right word, I think. You can tell a man who has been keeping all his anger to himself. It goes sour in him. It turns against itself and drives him to breaking rather than making.
I can think of men like that, I said. But I can think of women, too.
All things have anger, she repeated with a shrug. A stone does not have much compared to a budding tree. It is the same with people. Some have more or less. Some use it wisely. Some do not.
She gave me a wide smile.
I have a great deal, which is why I am so fond of sex and fierce in my fighting.
She bit at my chest again, less playfully this time, and began to work her way up to my neck.
But if you take the anger from a man in sex, I said, struggling to concentrate, doesn't that mean the more sex you have, the more you want? It is like the water one uses to prime a pump, she said hotly against my ear. Come now. I will have all of it, even if it takes us all day and half the night.
We eventually moved from the grassy field to the baths, and then to Penta's house of two snug rooms built against the side of a bluff. The moon was in the sky and had been watching us for some time through the window, though I doubt we showed her anything she hadn't seen before.
Is that enough for you?
I said breathlessly. We were side by side in her pleasantly capacious bed, the sweat drying off our bodies.
If you take much more of it, I might not have enough anger left to speak or breathe.
My hand lay on the flat plane of her belly. Her skin was soft and smooth, but when she laughed, I could feel the muscles of her stomach jump, going hard as sheets of steel.
It is enough for now, she said, exhaustion plain in her voice. It would upset Vachette if I left you empty as a fruit with all the juice pressed out.
Despite my long day, I was oddly wakeful, my thoughts bright and clear. I remembered something she had said earlier. You mentioned that a woman has many uses for her anger. What use does a woman have for it that a man does not?
We teach, she said. We give names. We track the days and tend to the smooth turning of things. We plant. We make babies.
She shrugged.
Many things.
A man can do those things as well, I said. Penta chuckled.
You have the wrong word, she said, rubbing at my chin. A beard is what a man makes. A baby is something different, and that you have no part of.
We don't carry the baby, I said, slightly offended. But still, we play our part in making it. Penta turned to look at me, smiling as if I had made a joke. Then her smile faded. She propped herself up on her elbow and looked at me for another long moment.
Are you in serious?
Seeing my perplexed expression, her eyes grew wide with amazement, and she sat upright on the bed.
It is true, she said. You believe in man-mothers.
She giggled, covering the bottom half of her face with both hands.
I never believed it was true.
She lowered her left hand, revealing an excited grin as she gestured, amazed delight. I felt I should be irritated, but I couldn't quite muster the energy. Perhaps some of what she said about men giving away their anger had some truth to it. What is a man-mother? I asked.
Are you not making a joke?
She asked, one hand still half-covering her smile.
Do you truly believe a man puts a baby in a woman?
Well, yes, I said a little awkwardly. In a manner of speaking, it takes a man and a woman to make a baby, a mother and a father.
You have a word for it, she said, delighted. They told me this, too, with the stories of dirt soup, but I never thought it the real story.
I sat up myself at this point, growing concerned. You do know how babies are made, don't you? I asked, gesturing serious earnestness. What we have been doing for most of the day is what makes a baby. She looked at me for a moment in stunned silence, then dissolved helplessly into laughter, trying to speak several times, only to have it overwhelm her again when she looked up at the expression on my face. Pentha put her hands on her belly, prodding it as if puzzled.
Where is my baby?
She looked down at her flat belly.
Perhaps I have been sexing wrong these years.
When she laughed, the muscles across her stomach flickered, making a pattern like a turtle shell.
I should have 100 babies if what you say is true. 500 babies.
It does not happen every time there is sex, I said. There are only certain times when a woman is ripe for a baby.
And have you done this?
She asked, looking at me with mock seriousness while a smile tugged at her mouth.
Have you made a baby with a woman?
I have been careful not to do such a thing, I said. There is an herb called silphium. I chew it every day and it keeps me from putting a baby in a woman. Pentha shook her head.
This is more of your barbarian sex rituals, she said. Does bringing a man to the flowers also make a baby where you come from?
I decided to take a different tack. If men do not help with making babies, how do you explain that babies look like their fathers?
Babies look like angry old men, Pentha said, all bald and with...
She hesitated, touching her cheek.
With face lines. Perhaps the old men are the only ones making babies then.
She smirked. What about kittens? I asked. You have seen a litter of kittens. When a white cat and a black cat have sex, you get kittens both white and black, and kittens of both colors.
Always? She asked.
Not always, I admitted, but most times.
But if there is a yellow kitten? She asked.
Before I could put together an answer, she waved the question away.
Kittens have little to do with this, she said. We are not like animals. We do not go into season. We do not lay eggs. We do not make cocoons or fruit or seeds. We are not dogs or frogs or trees.
Pentha gave me a serious look.
You are committing a false thinking. You could as easily say two stones make baby stones by banging against each other until a piece breaks off. Therefore, two people make baby peoples in the same way.
I fumed, but she was right. I was committing a fallacy of analogy. It was faulty logic. Our conversation continued along this vein for some time. I asked her if she had ever known a woman to get pregnant who had not had sex in the previous months. She said she didn't know of any woman who would willingly go 3 months without sex, except those who were traveling among the barbarians, or very ill, or very old. Eventually, Pentha waved a hand to stop me, gesturing exasperation.
Do you hear your own excuses? Sex makes babies, but not always. Babies look like man-mothers, but not always. The sex must be at the right time, but not always. There are plants that make it more likely or less likely.
She shook her head.
You must realize what you say is thin as a net. You keep sewing new threads hoping it will hold water, but hoping does not make it true.
Seeing me frown, she took my hand and gestured comfort into it as she had before in the dining hall, all the laughter gone out of her face.
I can see you think this truly. I can understand why barbarian men would want to believe it. It must be comforting to think you are important in this way, but it is simply not.
Pentha looked at me with something close to pity.
Sometimes a woman ripens. It is a natural thing, and men have no part in it. That is why more women ripen in the fall, like fruit. That is why more women ripen here in Hert, where it is better to have a child.
I tried to think of some other convincing argument, but none would come to mind. It was frustrating. Seeing my expression, Pentha squeezed my hand and gestured concession.
Perhaps it is different for barbarian women, she said.
You are only saying that to make me feel better, I said sullenly, and was overcome with a jaw-popping yawn.
I am,
she admitted. Then she gave me a gentle kiss and pushed at my shoulders, encouraging me to lie back down on the bed.
I did, and she nestled into the crook of my arm again, resting her head on my shoulder. It must be hard to be a man, she said softly. A woman knows she is part of the world. We are full of life. A woman is the flower and the fruit. We move through time as part of our children, but a man?
She turned her head and looked up at me with gentle pity in her eyes.
You are an empty branch. You know when you die, you will leave nothing of any import behind.
Pentha stroked my chest fondly.
I think that is why you are so full of anger. Maybe you do not have more than women. Maybe the anger in you simply has no place to go. Maybe it is desperate to leave some mark. It hammers at the world. It drives you to rash action, to bickering, to rage. You paint and build and fight and tell stories that are bigger than the truth.
She gave a contented sigh and rested her head on my shoulder, snuggling herself firmly into the circle of my arm.
I am sorry to tell you this thing. You are a good man and a pretty thing, but still, you are only a man. All you have to offer the world is your anger.
Chapter 128 Names. It was the day that I would either stay or leave. I sat with Vashet on a green hill, watching the sun rise out of the clouds to the east.
Saisra means to fly, to catch, to break,
Vashet said softly, repeating herself for the hundredth time. You must remember all the hands that have held her. Many hands, all following the Letani. You must never use her in an improper way. I promise, I said for the hundredth time, then hesitated before bringing up something that had been bothering me.
But, Vashet, you used your sword to trim the willow branch you beat me with.
I saw you use it to hold your window open once. You pare your nails with it. Vashet gave me a blank look.
Yes?
Isn't that improper? I asked. She cocked her head, then laughed.
You mean I should only use it for fighting?
I gestured, obvious implication.
A sword is sharp, she said. It is a tool. I carry it constantly. How is using it improper?
It seems disrespectful, I clarified.
You respect the thing by putting it to good use.
It may be years before I return to the barbarian lands and fight. How does it harm my sword if it cuts kindling and carrots in the meantime? Vashet's eyes grew serious.
To carry a sword your whole life, knowing it was only for killing.
She shook her head.
What would that do to a person's mind? It would be a horrible thing.
Vashet had returned to Hert last night, dismayed that she had missed my stone trial. She said I was right to lay aside my sword when Carceret did, and that I had made her proud. Yesterday, Cheyenne had formally invited me to stay and train at the school. In theory, I already earned that right, but everyone knew that was more of a political fiction than anything. Her offer was a flattering one, an opportunity I knew I would likely never have again. We watched a boy herd a flock of goats down the side of a hill. Vachette, is it true that the Adam have no concept of fatherhood? Vachette nodded easily, then paused. Tell me you did not embarrass both of us by talking about this with everyone while I was gone, she said with a sigh. Only with Penta, I said. She thought it was the funniest thing she had heard in 10 months' time.
It is fairly amusing at that, Vachette said, her mouth curving a little.
It's true, then? Even you believe this? You...
Vachette held up a hand, and I trailed off.
Peace, she said.
Think whatever you wish about your man-mothers. It is all the same to me.
She gave a soft smile of remembrance.
My poet king actually believed a woman was nothing more than the ground in which a man might plant a baby.
Vachette made an amused huffing sound that wasn't quite a laugh.
He was so sure he was right. Nothing could sway him. Years ago I decided arguing such things with a barbarian is a long, weary waste of my time.
She shrugged.
Think what you want about making babies. Believe in demons. Pray to a goat. So long as it doesn't bruise me, why should I bother myself?
I chewed it over for a moment.
There's wisdom in that, I said.
She nodded.
But either a man helps with a baby, or he does not, I pointed out. There can be many opinions on a thing, but there is only one truth.
Vachette smiled lazily.
And if the pursuit of truth was my goal, that would concern me.
She gave a long yawn, stretching like a happy cat.
Instead, I will focus on the joy in my heart, the prosperity of the school, and understanding the Lethani. If I have time left after that, I will put it toward worrying on the truth.
We watched the sunrise for a while longer in silence. It occurred to me Vachette was quite a different person when she wasn't struggling to cram the Catan and all of Ademic into my head as quickly as possible.
That said, Vachette added, if you persist in clinging to your barbarian beliefs about man-mothers, you would do well to keep quiet about it. Amusement is the best you can hope for. Most will simply assume you an idiot for thinking such things.
I nodded. After a long moment, I decided to finally ask the question I had been holding off for days.
Magwin called me Maedra. What does it mean?
It is your name, she said. Speak of it to no one.
It is a secret thing? I asked.
She nodded.
It is a thing for you and your teachers and Magwin. It would be dangerous to let others know what it is.
How could it be dangerous? Vachette looked at me as if I were daft.
When you know a name, you have power over it. Surely you know this.
But I know your name, and Cheyenne's, and Tempe's. What danger is in that?
She waved a hand. Not those names. Deep names. Tempe is not the name he was given by Magwin. Just as Quoth is not yours. Deep names have meanings.
I already knew what Vachette's name meant.
What does Tempe mean?
Tempe means little iron. Tempa means iron, and it means to strike iron, and it means angry. Cheyenne gave him that name years ago. He was a most troublesome student.
In Aturan, temper means angry. I pointed it out rather excitedly, amazed at the coincidence. And it is also something you do with iron when forging it into steel.
Vachette shrugged, unimpressed. That is the way of names. Tempe is a small name, and still it holds much. That is why you should not speak of yours, even to me.
But I do not know your language well enough to tell what it means myself, I protested.
A man should know the meaning of his own name.
Bashette hesitated, then relented.
It means flame and thunder and the broken tree.
I thought for a while and decided I liked it.
When Magwin gave it to me, you seemed surprised.
Why is that?
It is not proper for me to comment on another's name.
Absolute refusal. Her gesture was so sharp it almost hurt to look at. She came to her feet, then brushed her hands against her pants.
Come. It is time you gave your answer to Cheyenne.
Cheyenne motioned for us to sit as we entered her room. Then she took a seat herself, startling me by showing the smallest of smiles. It was a terribly flattering gesture of familiarity.
Have you decided? She asked.
I nodded. I thank you, Cheyenne, but I cannot stay. I must return to Severin to speak with the mayor. Tempe fulfilled his obligation when the road was made safe, but I am bound to return and explain everything that happened. I thought of Denna as well, but didn't mention her. Cheyenne gestured an elegant mingling of approval and regret.
Fulfilling one's duty is of the Lethani.
She gave me a serious look.
Remember, you have a sword and a name, but you must not hire yourself out as if you had taken the red.
Bashette has explained everything to me, I said, reassurance. I will make arrangements for my sword to be returned to Haert if I am killed. I will not teach the K-10 or wear the red. Carefully attentive curiosity. But I am permitted to tell others I have studied fighting with you. Reserved agreement.
You may say you have studied with us, but not that you are one of us.
Of course, I said, and not that I am equal to you. Cheyenne gestured, content satisfaction. Then her hands shifted, and she made a small gesture of embarrassed admission.
This is not entirely a gift, she said. You will be a better fighter than many barbarians. If you fight and win, the barbarians will think, Kvol studied only slightly the Adem arts, and still he is formidable. How much more skilled must they themselves be?
However,
if you fight and lose, they will think, he only learned a piece of what the Adem know.
The old woman's eyes twinkled ever so slightly. She gestured, amusement.
No matter what, our reputation thrives. This serves Adamre.
I nodded, willing acceptance. It will not hurt my reputation either, I said, understatement. There was a pause in the conversation, then Cheyenne gestured solemn importance.
When we spoke before, you asked me of the Rinta. Do you remember?
Cheyenne asked. From the corner of my eye, I saw Vashette shift uncomfortably in her seat. Suddenly excited, I nodded.
I have remembered a story of such. Would you like to hear it?
I gestured extreme eager interest.
It is an old story, old as a Demre. It is always told the same. Are you ready to hear it?
Profound formality. There was a hint of ritual in her voice. I nodded again, pleading entreaty.
As with all things, there are rules. I will tell you this story once. After, you may not speak of it. After, you may not ask questions.
Cheyenne looked back and forth between Vashette and myself. Grave seriousness.
Not until you have slept 1,000 nights may you speak on this. Not until you have traveled 1,000 miles may you ask questions. Knowing this, are you willing to hear it?
I nodded a third time, my excitement rising in me. Cheyenne spoke with great formality.
Once there was a great realm peopled by great people. They were not Adamre. They were what Adamre was before we became ourselves. But at this time they were themselves, the women and men, fair and strong. They sang songs of power and fought as well as Adamre do. These people had a great empire. The name of the empire is forgotten. It is not important, as the empire has fallen. And since that time, the land has broken, and the sky changed. In the empire there were 7 cities, and 1 city. The names of the 7 cities are forgotten, for they are fallen to treachery and destroyed by time. The 1 city was destroyed as well, but its name remains. It was called Tarinial. The empire had an enemy, as strength must have, but the enemy was not great enough to pull it down. Not by pulling or pushing was the enemy strong enough to drag it down. The enemy's name is remembered, but it will wait. Since not by strength could the enemy win, he moved like a worm in fruit. The enemy was not of the Lethani. He poisoned 7 others against the empire, and they forgot the Lethani. 6 of them betrayed the cities that trusted them. 6 cities fell, and their names are forgotten. 1 remembered the Lethani, and did not betray a city. That city did not fall. 1 of them remembered the Lethani, and the empire was left with hope. With 1 unfallen city. But even the name of that city is forgotten, buried in time. But 7 names are remembered. The name of the 1 and of the 6 who follow him. 7 names have been carried through the crumbling of empire, through the broken land and changing sky. 7 names are remembered through the long wandering of Edemre. 7 names have been remembered, the names of the 7 traitors. Remember them and know them by their 7 signs. Siphus bears the blue flame. Stertius is in thrall of iron. Ferul chill and dark of eye. Usnia lives in nothing but decay. Grey Dalcenti never speaks. Pale Alenta brings the blight. Last, there is the Lord of 7. Hated, hopeless, sleepless, sane. Alaxel bears the shadow's hame. Chapter 129. Interlude. Din of Whispering.
Reshi!
Bast cried out, his face stricken.
No! Stop!
He held out his hands as if he would press them against the innkeeper's mouth.
You shouldn't say such things!
Quoth smiled in a humorless way. Bast, who taught you your name lore in the first place?
Not you, Reshi!
Bast shook his head.
There are things every fey child knows. It's never good to speak such things aloud. Not ever.
And why is that? Quoth prompted in his best teacher's voice.
Because some things can tell when their names are spoken.
Bast swallowed.
They can tell where they're spoken.
Quoth gave a somewhat exasperated sigh. There is small harm in saying a name once, Bast. He sat back in his chair. Why do you think the Adem have their traditions surrounding that particular story? Only once, and no questions after? Bast's eyes narrowed thoughtfully, and Quoth gave him a small, tight smile. Exactly. Trying to find someone who speaks your name once is like tracking a man through a forest from a single footprint. Chronicler spoke up hesitantly, as if afraid of interrupting.
Can such a thing really be done? He asked.
Truthfully? Quoth nodded grimly. I expect that's how they found my troop when I was young. Chronicler looked around nervously, then frowned and made an obvious effort to stop. The result was that he sat very still, looking every bit as nervous as before.
Does that mean they might come here? You've certainly been talking about them enough.
Quoth made a dismissive gesture. No. Names are the key. Real names. Deep names. And I have been avoiding them for just that reason. My father was a great one for details. He had been asking questions and digging up old stories about the Chandrian for years. I expect he stumbled onto a few of their old names and worked them into his song. Understanding washed over Chronicler's face. And then rehearsed it again and again. The innkeeper gave a faint, fond smile. Endlessly, if I knew him at all. I have no doubt he and my mother did their solid best to work every tiny burr out of their song before they made it public. They were perfectionists. He gave a tired sigh. To the Chandrian, he must have been like someone constantly lighting a signal fire. I expect the only thing that kept them safe for so long was that we were constantly traveling. Bast broke in again. Which is why you shouldn't say such things, Reshi. Quoth frowned. I have slept my 1,000 nights and traveled several 1,000 miles since then, Bast. It is safe to say them once. With all the hell that's breaking loose in the world these days, you can believe people are telling old stories more often. If the Chandrian are listening for names, I don't doubt they've got a slow din of whispering from Arua to the Circle Sea. Bast's expression made it clear he was less than reassured. Besides, Quoth said with a bit of a weary sigh, it's good to have them written down. They may prove useful to someone someday. Still, Reshi, you should be more careful. What have I been these last years except for careful, Bast? Quoth said, his irritation finally bubbling to the surface. What good has it done me? Besides, if what you say about the Cathay is true, then things will end in tears no matter what I do. Isn't that right? Bast opened his mouth, then closed it, obviously at a loss. Then he darted a look toward Chronicler, his eyes pleading for support. Seeing this, Quoth turned to look at Chronicler as well, raising an eyebrow curiously. I'm sure I don't know in the least, Chronicler said, looking down as he opened his satchel and brought out an ink-stained piece of cloth. Both of you have seen the full extent of my naming prowess. Iron. And that is a fluke by all accounts. Master Namer declared me an utter waste of his time. That sounds familiar, Quoth murmured. Chronicler shrugged. In my case, I took him at his word. Can you remember the excuse he gave you? He had many specific criticisms. I knew too many words. I'd never been hungry. I was too soft. Chronicler's hands were busy cleaning the nib of his pen. I felt he made his overall position clear when he said, Who would have thought a papery little scriv like you could have any iron in him at all? Quoth's mouth quirked into a sympathetic smile. Did he really? Chronicler shrugged. He called me a twat, actually. I was trying not to offend the innocent ears of our young friend here. He nodded at Bast. From what I can tell, he's had a rough day. Quoth smiled in full now. It's a shame we weren't ever at the university at the same time. Chronicler gave the nib one last rub against the soft cloth and held it up to the fading light from the inn's window. Not really, he said. You wouldn't have liked me. I was a papery little twat. And spoiled. And full of myself.
And what's changed since then? Quoth asked.
Chronicler blew air through his nose dismissively.
Not much, depending who you ask. But I like to think I've had my eyes opened a bit.
He screwed the nib carefully back into his pen.
And how did that happen exactly? Quoth asked.
Chronicler looked across the table, seeming surprised at the question.
Exactly? He asked. Telling a story isn't what I'm here for.
He tucked the cloth back into his satchel.
In brief, I had a snit and left the university looking for greener pasture. Best thing I ever did. I learned more from a month on the road than I had in 3 years of classes.
Quoth nodded.
Teckum said the same thing. No man is brave that has never walked 100 miles. If you want to know the truth of who you are, walk until not a person knows your name. Travel is the great leveler, the great teacher, bitter as medicine, crueler than mirror glass. A long stretch of road will teach you more about yourself than 100 years of quiet introspection.
Chapter 130, Wine and Water. Saying my farewells in Hert took an entire day. I shared a meal with Vachette and Tempe, and let both of them give me more advice than I needed or desired. Celian cried a bit and told me she would come visit me when she finally took the red. We bouted one final time, and I suspect she let me win. Lastly, I spent a pleasant evening with Pentha that turned into a pleasant night and eventually into a pleasant late night. I did manage to catch a few hours of sleep in the pale hours before dawn. I grew up among the Rue, so I am endlessly amazed how quickly a person can put down roots in a place. Though I had been in Haert less than 2 months, it was hard to leave. Still, it felt good to be back on the road again, heading toward Alvaron and Denna. It was time I collected my reward for a job well done and delivered an earnest and rather belated apology. 5 days later, I was walking one of those long, lonely stretches of road you only find in the low hills of eastern Vintis. I was, as my father used to say, on the edge of the map. I had only passed one or two travelers all day, and not a single inn. The thought of sleeping outdoors wasn't particularly troubling, but I had been eating from my pockets for a couple days, and a warm meal would have been a welcome thing. Night had nearly fallen, and I had given up hope of something decent in my stomach when I spotted a line of white smoke trailing into the twilight sky ahead of me. I took it for a farmhouse at first. Then I heard a faint strain of music, and my hopes for a bed and hearth-hot meal began to rise. But as I came around a curve in the road, I found a surprise better than any roadside inn. Through the trees, I saw a tall campfire flickering between two achingly familiar wagons. Men and women lounged about, talking. One strummed a lute, while another tapped a small tabor idly against his leg. Others were pitching a tent between two trees while an older woman set a tripod over the fire. Troopers. What's better, I recognized familiar markings on the side of one of the wagons. To me, they stood out more brightly than the fire. Those signs meant that these were true troopers. My family, the Adema Rue. As I stepped from the trees, one of the men gave a shout, and before I could draw breath to speak, there were three swords pointing at me. The sudden stillness after the music and chatter was more than slightly unnerving. A handsome man with a black beard and a silver earring took a slow step forward, never taking the tip of his sword off my eye.
"Otto!" he shouted into the woods behind me. "If you're napping, I swear on my mother's milk I'll gut you!" "Who the hell are you?"
The last was directed at me. But before I could respond, a voice came out of the trees.
"I'm right here, Alec. As... who's that? How in the God's name did he get past me?"
When they'd drawn their swords on me, I'd raised my hands. It's a good habit to have when anyone points something sharp at you. Nevertheless, I was smiling as I spoke. "Sorry to startle you, Alec."
"Save it," he said coldly. "You have one breath left to tell me why you were sneaking around our camp."
I had no need to talk, and instead turned so everyone by the fire could see the loot case slung across my back. The change in Alec's attitude was immediate. He relaxed and sheathed his sword. The others followed suit as he smiled and approached me, laughing. I laughed, too.
"One family! One family!"
He shook my hand and turned toward the fire, shouting,
"Best behavior, everyone! We have a guest tonight!"
There was a low cheer, and everyone went busily back to whatever they had been doing before I arrived. A thick-bodied man wearing a sword stomped out of the trees.
"I'll be damned if he came past me, Alec! He's probably from..."
"He's from our family," Alec interjected smoothly.
"Oh,"
Otto said, obviously taken aback. He looked at my loot.
"Welcome, then."
"I didn't go past, actually," I lied. When it was dark, my shade made me very difficult to see, but that wasn't his fault, and I didn't want to get him in trouble. "I heard the music and circled around. I thought you might be a different troop, and I was going to surprise them." Otto gave Alec a pointed look, then turned and stomped back into the woods. Alec put his arm around my shoulders.
"Might I offer you a drink?"
"A little water, if you can spare it."
"No guest drinks water by our fire," he protested. Only our best wine will touch your lips.
The water of the Edema is sweeter than wine to those who have been upon the road. I smiled at him.
Then have water and wine, each to your desire.
He led me to one of the wagons, where there was a water barrel. Following a tradition older than time, I drank a ladle of water and used a second to wash my hands and face. Patting my face dry with the sleeve of my shirt, I looked up at him and smiled. It's good to be home again. He clapped me on the back.
Come, let me introduce you to the rest of your family.
First were two men of about 20, both with scruffy beards.
Fran and Josh are our two best singers, excepting myself, of course.
I shook their hands. Next were the two men playing instruments around the fire.
Gaskin plays lute. Laren does pipes and tabor.
They smiled at me. Laren struck the head of the tabor with his thumb, and the drum made a mellow tum.
There's Tim, Alec pointed across the fire to a tall, grim man oiling a sword. And you've already met Otto. They keep us from falling into danger on the road.
Tim nodded, looking up briefly from his sword.
This is Anne.
Alec gestured to an older woman with a pinched expression and gray hair pulled back in a bun.
She keeps us fed and plays mother to us all.
Anne continued to cut carrots, ignoring both of us.
And far from last is our own sweet Kate, who holds the key to all our hearts.
Kate had hard eyes and a mouth like a thin line, but her expression softened a little when I kissed her hand.
And that's everyone, Alag said with a smile and a little bow. Your name is?
Quoth.
Welcome, Quoth.
Rest yourself and be at your ease. Is there anything we can do for you?
A bit of that wine you mentioned earlier. I smiled.
He touched the heel of his hand to his forehead. Of course!
Or would you prefer ale?
I nodded, and he fetched me a mug.
Excellent, I said after tasting it, seating myself on a convenient stump.
He tipped an imaginary hat.
Thank you. We were lucky enough to nick it on our way through Levenshire a couple days ago. How has the road been treating you of late?
I stretched backward and sighed.
Not bad for a lone minstrel, I shrugged.
I take advantage of what opportunities present themselves. I have to be careful since I'm alone.
Alag nodded wisely.
The only safety we have is in numbers,
he admitted, then nodded to my lute.
Would you favor us with a bit of a song while we're waiting for Anne to finish dinner?
Certainly, I said, setting down my drink. What would you like to hear?
Can you play Leave the Town Tinker?
Can I? You tell me. I lifted my lute from its case and began to play. By the chorus, everyone had stopped what they were doing to listen. I even caught sight of Otto near the edge of the trees as he left his lookout to peer toward the fire. When I was done, everyone applauded enthusiastically.
You can play it,
Alag laughed. Then his expression became serious, and he tapped a finger to his mouth.
How would you like to walk the road with us for a while?
He asked after a moment.
We could use another player.
I took a moment to consider it. Which way are you heading?
Easterly, he said.
I'm bound for Severn, I said.
Alec shrugged. We can make it to Severn, he said, so long as you don't mind taking the long way around.
I have been away from the family for a long time, I admitted, looking at the familiar sights around the fire.
One is a bad number for an edema on the road,
Alec said persuasively, running a finger along the edge of his dark beard. I sighed.
Ask me again in the morning.
He slapped my knee, grinning.
Good! That means we have all night to convince you.
I replaced my lute and excused myself for a call of nature. Coming back, I knelt next to Anne where she sat near the fire.
What are you making for us, Mother?
I asked.
Stew, she said shortly.
I smiled.
What's in it?
Anne squinted at me.
Lamb, she said, as if daring me to challenge the fact.
It's been a long while since I've had lamb, Mother. Could I have a taste?
You'll wait, same as everyone else, she said sharply.
Not even a small taste? I wheedled, giving her my best ingratiating smile. The old woman drew a breath, then shrugged it away.
Fine, she said, but it won't be my fault if your stomach sets to aching.
I laughed. No, mother, it won't be your fault. I reached for the long-handled wooden spoon and drew it out. After blowing on it, I took a bite.
Mother!
I exclaimed. This is the best thing to touch my lips in a full year.
Humph,
she said, squinting at me. It's the first truth, mother, I said earnestly. Anyone who does not enjoy this fine stew is hardly one of the roux, in my opinion. Anne turned back to stir the pot and shooed me away, but her expression wasn't as sharp as it had been before. After stopping by the keg to refill my mug, I returned to my seat. Gaskin leaned forward.
You've given us a song. Is there anything you'd like to hear?
How about Piper Witt? I asked. His brow furrowed.
I don't recognize that one.
It's about a clever roux who outwits a farmer. Gaskin shook his head.
I'm afraid not.
I bent to pick up my lute. Let me. It's a song every one of us should know.
Pick something else, Laren protested. I'll play you something on the pipes. You've played for us once already tonight.
I smiled at him. I forgot you piped. You'll like this one, I assured him. Piper's the hero. Besides, you're feeding my belly. I'll feed your ears. Before they could raise any more objections, I started to play quick and light. They laughed through the whole thing. From the beginning, when Piper kills the farmer, to the end, when he seduces the dead man's wife and daughter. I left off the last two verses where the townsfolk kill Piper. Laren wiped his eyes after I was done.
Heh, you're right, Quoth. I'm better off knowing that one. Besides...
He shot a look at Kate where she sat across the fire.
It's an honest song. Women can't keep their hands off a Piper.
Kate snorted derisively and rolled her eyes. We talked of small things until Anne announced the stew was done. Everyone fell to, breaking the silence only to compliment Anne on her cooking.
Honestly, Anne, Aleg asked after his second bowl, did you lift a little pepper back in Levenshire?
Anne looked smug.
We all need our secrets, dear, she said. Don't press a lady.
I asked Aleg, have times been good for you and yours?
Oh, certainly, he said between mouthfuls. 3 days ago, Levenshire was especially good to us.
He winked.
You'll see how good later.
I'm glad to hear it.
In fact, he leaned forward conspiratorially, we've done so well that I feel quite generous. Generous enough to offer you anything you'd like. Anything at all. Ask and it's yours.
He leaned closer and said in a stage whisper,
I want you to know this is a blatant attempt to bribe you into staying on with us. We would make a thick purse off that lovely voice of yours.
Not to mention the songs he could teach us,
Gaskin chimed in.
Aleg gave a mock snarl. Don't help him bargain, boy. I have the feeling this is going to be hard enough as it is.
I gave it a little thought.
I suppose I could stay...
I let myself trail off uncertainly. Aleg gave a knowing smile.
But?
But I would ask for 3 things.
Hmm, 3 things.
He looked me up and down.
Just like in one of the stories.
It only seems right, I urged. He gave a hesitant nod.
I suppose it does. And how long would you travel with us?
Until no one objects to my leaving.
Does anyone have any problem with this?
Aleg looked around.
What if he asks for one of the wagons?
Tim asked. His voice startled me, harsh and rasping like 2 bricks grating together.
It won't matter, as he'll be traveling with us, Aleg argued. They belong to all of us anyway, and since he can't leave unless we say so...
There were no objections. Aleg and I shook hands, and there was a small cheer. Kate held up her mug.
To Quoth and his songs, she said.
I have a feeling he'll be worth whatever he costs us.
Everyone drank, and I held up my own glass. I swear on my mother's milk,